Brother Tim, Brother Ray. Very nice to hear your voices singing, brethren. That's a really joyful noise unto the Lord, and I appreciate it very much. Updating the Middle East, I subtitled this a review of Israel's current turmoil, part one, in the light of history, part two, but one time I was very overly optimistic, and I tried to get through both parts, and everybody was left with their head spinning. So I'm just going to do part one, and you'll have to wonder what part two is all about. Before I do that, like the last two speakers, I want to bring you love from our class. Now, you notice the difference between the two classes you saw and our class, right? This is our favorite activity, not staring at the camera, but we have a good study, and then we eat together. But you do see Brother George and Sister Ruth there, and Brother George, the class sends their love, and they especially are not able to get out the way they did, but they certainly send their love along. And also, Rachel and I are here for the convention. We appreciate being here, but both Aaron and Gretchen send their love as well and are wishing they could be here as well. Anybody know who this is? Yes, you learn how to pronounce it over the few years. That's very good. That was the major task of a guy like that. Let's talk about what he said. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said if he ever became the supreme decision maker in his country, of course, what country is that? Iran. He said he would sacrifice half of Iran for the sake of eliminating Israel. Well, he has this religious conviction that Israel's demise really is essential to the restoration of Muslim glory. Now, it's interesting, you know, they're really not part of the Arab nations. This is a Persian nation. But yet, it allies itself greatly with a common enemy of Israel. What he called the Zionist thorn in the heart of the Islamic nations must be removed. Now, he said he'll pay any price for it. And, as you know, he loves to deny the Holocaust and everything else. And if he became the supreme leader and has nuclear capability, well, I think that's really a real threat. Now, fortunately, right now, he is not the supreme leader. The ultimate decision maker in Iran is the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who is now about 70 years old. Interestingly enough, I don't know if you saw, but he just dismissed the new president's greeting, New Year's greeting that came in. It was the first time he's spoken out since we had an election here. And you know that, of course, Iran and Ahmadinejad really had great disdain for George Bush. But anyways, it looks like his point is we're not going to be any more friendly with this administration than we were with the last one. So, and despite Ahmadinejad's previously mentioned offer, I'm glad to talk. This cleric is saying no, and he certainly right now is the one that is at least calling the shots. Whether Ahmadinejad lasts or not, we may find out soon. But I think as I go through this, hopefully you see, I think there are two simple truths that you need to keep in mind when you look at current events surrounding the nation of Israel. You know, our love for Israel is shared by others, but not in the same way, because we are unique in believing that God is going to set up his kingdom through Israel and administer the new covenant to the whole world from that nation. Now, there are many that share a love for Israel, evangelicals and what forth, but there is a purpose in mind. If you read ultimately, they don't hold the same subscription that we do and the role for Israel in the future. There is a limit as to where they think they will go. But the important thing for us, I think, as we look at the current events of Israel today and what's going on in the Middle East, two simple truths that you need to keep in mind. The first truth, if the surrounding nations, Iran, all the Muslim nations around, even those that are in their own midst, if they were to put down their weapons today, there'd be no more violence in the Middle East. Israel would repeat. However, the second truth is perhaps more important at this point. If the Jewish nation put down their weapons, there would be no more Israel. Now, of course, we realize that God is watching over them, but I hope to stir you to think that perhaps, condemning the warlike position of Israel is not something currently we should be doing, because I think there is a purpose in what God has given them till that comes to the time when he's ready to intervene in affairs. But it is important to realize that at this point they really have no choice but to defend themselves. Well, how big a threat are the Jews? Everyone hates them for some reason, and we could trace in part two some of that reasons, which I won't get to, but how big a threat really are they in the world today? Well, if we filled a room, we didn't need a little bigger room than this, but if we had 453 people from a cross-section of the whole world population, how many would be Jewish? You're right, Walter. One. Well, think about that. If you're outnumbered 453-1, not many people can fight those odds. So you know that the fact that the Lord is really favoring them and what's been going on is quite evident. And they're not a threat to the population at all, but there's this intense hatred that exists all around the nation of Israel for them and for many others that feel the same way. Well, let's take a look at the Middle East. There's Israel in the middle. It's 23 countries in one of the most populous regions that we have in the world. About 190 million people estimated in this whole area, perhaps a little more than that now. But it's not a lot of land mass, as you can see. We have 233 million currently in kind of the broader aspect. We've included some countries that you might not think about currently, but those that are right around Israel. If you look at those nations, as you can see, Israel has a total population, as you see here, about 7.2 million people. And I've included the land, the square miles, about 8,000 square miles, which does include the land that they evacuated back in 2005. But you can see that this whole position about Israel is not about their land. They really are dwarfing when you think about 2.1 million square miles there, and a mere 8,000 isn't going to do much except get rid of them. So I think it's not about the land. It's really about the hatred that people have for them. Historically, you can go back and look at a conflict that's existed pretty much forever. If we look at when this started, of course, remember Ishmael, who became the father of many of the Bedouin nations. Back in Genesis 25, Ishmael went to Paran, and if we track through the descendants there, they became the Midianites, the Edomites, the Egyptians, some of the Assyrians. And the Islamic tradition, of course, says that they settled in Mecca. Genesis 16:12, I think, is pertinent, saying that really Ishmael became the leader of all the desert people. And by and large, a lot of those Bedouins today amongst the Arab nations would track back to Ishmael. First conflict we have with Israel very early in their career. Now, Numbers isn't a book we read a lot. I found a few classes that study the book of Numbers, but it's a very interesting book because it does relate a lot of the experiences that Israel had, some of them wandering across into the Promised Land. But the first conflict we find is in Numbers 20. And you may remember that when Moses brought Israel from Egypt, there were occupants around the land. They were the Canaanites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the Moabites, Midianites, Philistines, the Kenites, the Perizzites, and the Rephaim. And remember what God told them. Don't hurt them. Don't disturb the occupants. And so Moses sends his messengers through to the king of Edom at the time. He said, look, we've got a common ancestry. We can trace our roots back a long way together. And we just want to pass through the land safely. We're not going to do anything. We don't want to harm you. And what did they say? Of course, they said, no. We won't have you go through here. Twice he tried to do that. They refused safe passage, and so Israel had to deal with that. And they, from that point on, pretty much became a perpetual nuisance to Israel in the history of their land. Now let's look at a modern history. You know, Arab and Jewish refugees, we talk about today, there's a big contention around the refugees that were expelled in 1948. But if we go back historically, in 1948, the Arab refugees that left were encouraged to leave. Why? The Arab leaders said, look, we're going to launch a war against Israel right away. We're going to purge land. You can go back. So encourage them to leave. Well, 68% of them, if you look, left without ever seeing a soldier. They just left, picked up and left out. Now the call has been, well, you know, these people were kicked out. They got to get back into this land. But yet they left quite willingly. But yet, if you look at what happened in the surrounding nations where many of the Jewish people were living, they were forced to flee from those lands. There were pogroms, there was brutality, there was persecution, there were all kinds of launches driving them out. And so naturally they went into the newly formed area of Israel right before they had the War of Independence. So if you looked at the estimated land that combined the holdings that were lost by the Jews that fled the Arab lands, it was about equal to the area of the state of Israel. So it really wasn't any big forfeiting of land. It was an exchange of land at best. If you look at the number of people that left, the Arab refugees that left Israel in 1948, 630,000. Interesting, isn't it? The number of Jews that left the Arab lands, same number, 630,000. So is it really an issue of being kicked out and no place to go? I often think about that as an atheist. You know, an atheist, what you say at an atheist's funeral, if you were to give a eulogy, he's all dressed up and nowhere to go. Since the Jewish conquest in the 13th century, the Jews have had dominion over this area for at least 1,000 years, and the continuous presence, we can trace them back for some 3,300 years other than one small part. The only Arab dominion lasted, since that conquest, lasted roughly 22 years in 635 AD. But of course, a lot of things changed in 2005, didn't they? August of 2005, there were some huge events that transformed the country of Israel. Israel handed over all of Gaza and a part of the West Bank to the Palestinians. And it's the first country that we can track that really in modern history gave up the land that they acquired in what would be a defensive war. Remember, they were not on the offense in these, but they were defending themselves and were acquiring the land. And they were assaulted at least six times during that time, each time they had won in a defensive war. Now, we haven't really fought a defensive war on our own land, but even you think about conquering our land, there are some people say, well, we should give something back to, you know, to the Native Americans and others, but Israel's being asked to give up pretty much everything that they got when they were assigned and became a nation. But if you look at really what happened before all this happened, there were about 430,000 West Bank Palestinians already that moved freely. They could travel wherever they wanted to go. Today there's zero Israelis that are in Gaza. For 1.2 million Arabs in Israel that were their full legal citizens before this happened. And now 1.3 million Palestinians living in Gaza that have their own leaders today. I guess you'd call them leaders. I think that's where we need some of these impotent politicians that Brother Richard talked about there, because they certainly aren't doing them any favors. 820,000 Jewish refugees that were forced from the Arab lands back in 1947-48. No compensation was ever given to them. The Arab refugees that left Israel, and these slightly different numbers because we have a few extra years in here, from 47 to 49, that group now elects they've always elected the Palestinian leaders. And if you look at what happened in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, four northern West Bank settlements were abandoned. That was more than double the size of what Gaza was. So it really was a momentous event. And I think one of the lessons that we certainly looked at was the fact that God gave Israel a definitive boundary for their land. I think Exodus 23, 31 to 33, and there's, of course, debates over what the exact land is, but I think the point that I want you to take from this is you look at what God told them, the underlying part. He fixed their boundary, and then he said, "You shall make no covenant with them. They shall not live in your land." Well, I think they violated that. And what do I say? Was Israel's abandonment of the land God's will? I think based on that scripture, I think the answer is no. And I think what we've been seeing is a sort of punishment for what has happened. It's not God's will for them to give this up. And I think the more that we see the pressure coming on them from the outside, the more we realize that God is not going to be happy as they forfeit land that is not theirs but his and given to them and their to their descendants. Just last week, on March 25th, last Wednesday, the United Nations Human Rights Council gave this long list accusing Israel of all kinds of crimes in Gaza during Operation Cast Lead. Remember, Operation Cast Lead was where they were going in because Hamas had built a number of tunnels, and they were freely smuggling things back and forth through those tunnels, arms and all kinds of things, and really putting it in a bad position to prepare an attack against Israel. So they decided to go in January, of course, and then the United Nations came out last Wednesday and said, "Here's all the accusations that we're saying against you." It was a press conference that they held, and a UN associate spokesperson said there was a specific incident where an 11-year-old boy was used as a human shield by Israeli army soldiers. Same spokesperson then says, the allegations against Hamas and all the terrorist groups remain unverified. So they got one incident, they verified, and they're saying all these things that you're saying Hamas did is unverified. And the UN indicated an investigation is underway. Don't you love that? When someone says an investigation is underway. So that's always a significant event, but it is always interesting. Now, the Southern Command of Israel, Chief Major General Yoav Gallant, said, "I'm proud that we have such a moral army which respects international law," he said during an event that honored the medical corps. Remember, they went in to help many of the refugees. Gallant spoke of the extensive preparations carried out ahead of the operation and of Hamas's attempt to involve civilians in the fighting. And one of the things he talked about was a Palestinian gunman held his arms cache in his home, came out to fight, and went back to the house, believing that we will not target him there, he said. Well, all in all, he says 800 terrorists and 300 civilians that we didn't want to hurt had been killed in the operation. That ratio of almost a quarter uninvolved victims is unprecedented accomplishment in the history of campaigns of this nature. I think we all see that they were very careful not to do this. I think there's a promise given in Numbers 10 that I think I would apply to the situation that Israel's in today. Numbers 10:9, God gave them a promise, and he said, "When you go to war in your land against the enemy that oppresses you, then you shall sound an alarm with the trumpets, and you will be remembered before the Lord your God, and you will be saved from your enemies." Now, I'm not advocating the violence of war, but I would suggest to you, that when you saw the brief history we talked about, Israel has always had to fight from the first days they came into the land. They had no choice. They were always defending themselves. And I personally think that's going to happen up until the time when God intervenes, because they won't have the power to destroy the enemy that comes to them from the north that we're told about in Ezekiel. But I think it shouldn't make us fret that Israel is defending itself, because I think God has always told them that they're going to have to fight for what they have, because others are determined to wipe them out. But I think it is a crossroads for Israel today. And the reason I think it's important for us to look at, because it is one of those signs that of the times that indicates that we are at a crisis situation in world history as well as the history of Israel. That yes, one of the signs we know is Israel of the Lord's return and of God's working to bring His kingdom to the earth. The Middle East has changed so radically in the last decade. There's been a big balance of power shifts, strategic alliances have shifted, and it really is a crossroads today in the Middle East. And you know the interesting thing that has happened in the midst of all the economic difficulties around the world and some of the things that Richard mentioned in his talk is that today there's been very little attention paid to the Middle East. Things have been progressing rapidly there, but yet most of the news has been outside of that area. But I want to take a brief look across that Middle East, some of those countries we talked about, to show you the distinct shift that's happened in the last decade that really should lead us to believe that God is certainly preparing to, on a much bigger scale, involve Himself in this area. The Middle East has changed so radically. The first area let's look at is Jordan. Remember King Hussein of Jordan. He ruled from 1952 to 1999, soon after Israel was established as a nation. And then he was succeeded by his son Abdullah II. Now, it hasn't been a significant point, but certainly Jordan has not been a great friend. Michael Suleiman, who assumed the office in May of 2008, who was a former commander of the armed forces, now is a part of that area of Lebanon. Of course, that's an area that's a very sensitive area. But again, much power shift that we've seen occurring there. He had great conflict with Syria, and you know they have been in constant battles over who has the right to rule over that arena. And of course, when Israel was in a war and defeated several years ago, the first time, there was a lot of to-do that they really pretty much stayed out of that fight. Another area where we've seen a significant change is in Morocco. King Hassan II of Morocco was in power for 38 years. Again, up until 1999. Died in 1999, succeeded by his son, Sidi Mohammed VI, who is, and the sovereignty of that area is still in great dispute. But again, we see a leader who ruled for many years during all those years of formative time of Israel and the Middle East being set up. Today, significant change in the last decade. In Syria. Syria, we've seen Hafez Assad, who was a three-decade ruler, again, 30 years, died in 2000. You notice how many changes we had in that decade as the years turned. And his son Bashar took over then. Now, Bashar Assad, after his father died, he assumes his control, and he's trying to do a lot to modernize that country. His father ruled with an iron fist. He's got the same kind of authoritarian vein that you see. And he was the one that really forced to withdraw the troops from Lebanon. But again, there's still great dispute because he was personally implicated in some of the early slaying of former Lebanon ruler Rafik Hariri, and his son still is in seeking refuge because he's afraid to go back. And of course, Saddam Hussein. I guess you'd have to be kind of dead if you didn't know what happened to Saddam Hussein in the last 10 years. 20 years in power, driven out by the 2003 U.S.-led invasion. Now, Nouri Kamal al-Maliki is the prime minister since May of 2006. As you know, there's a lot of things changing in Iraq, and it's rather not it will be successful, but we're seeing still significant change. I want to spend a little time on this one because I think it's very significant as to what happened in Iraq and why we've gotten into the problems we did. Of course, I didn't have to put the names up there. You know who these are. George Bush and Saddam Hussein. Now, there was a lot of to-do around this whole area of George Bush and Saddam Hussein. But I'm going to suggest something to you. You know, you may or may not have liked George Bush. But I want to suggest that I think perhaps the Lord did use him in this case of Iraq. if we go back to the time when Saddam Hussein was ruling, Saddam Hussein was a known sponsor of terror. And he openly funded much of the Palestinian terror that was going on all during the time when Israel was being conflicted. In fact, he contributed, we can track the money, that he contributed $30 to $35 million to the families of the genocide bombers. Now, I don't call them suicide bombers because they're really not. Their objective is to just kill as many people as possible, not themselves. Okay, so, but he channeled all that through the Arab Liberation Front. And they were in both the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. Now, interestingly enough, we can track his last payment to April 2003. That was just 2 months before the U.S. assault. He was the only real Arab leader of many of those we mentioned and changes that took place that really sided morally and financially. Many said things, but he was the only one that really put his money where his mouth was and really put up money for the Palestinians. Now, the interesting thing in this is that if we look at the Israeli strategic planners, one of the things that they always feared was that Jordan would be swallowed up by Iraq. And you can see we're from Iraq to Jordan. As you can see, it's a very short point that Jordan would be swallowed by Iraq. And that would allow the Palestinians to attack from that eastern front along with those who are coming from Iraq and Jordan. And a peace treaty now is in force with Jordan that Saddam Hussein is gone, and it removed that threat. But I think, if nothing else, I think perhaps the Lord put it in George Bush's heart that this was something to do and perhaps prepared for it even when his father was still in office. But no matter what you think about him personally, I really think in a case like this we could see a real threat to Israel's existence. And I think for some reason the Lord used him in that manner. Of course, he paid a dear price, but I think Israel was relieved of that threat. And of course, we had Yasser Arafat, one of the most popular characters and the most good-looking man I've ever seen. But he was 4 decades leading that Palestinian movement and died in 2004. And of course, you know, since then, the Fatah party really surrendered their power in the elections, and now Hamas rules to a great extent, and there's a continuous war as to who's going to be heading that Palestinian area. And with the recent attacks coming and destruction of some of those areas, I think this is still a very serious problem. And I think it's going to continue to be a serious problem because, as I said earlier, I don't think that the Lord was really sanctioning this sort of thing. Now let's move on to Saudi Arabia. Well, King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, again, a 23-year reign, so long of these people. And then in 2005, he dies. His half-brother, Abdullah Aziz, becomes the king. You know, Saudi Arabia is a distinct cultural paradox. It really is one of the most open countries in the Middle East. You can go there and you feel perfectly safe. In fact, you see all kinds of satellites and television, and interestingly enough, I mean, you think we have a lot of cell phones. I heard a couple of them ringing here today. But if you go there, you're going to hear cell phones all over the place. It's the highest cell phone use and the highest internet usage of anywhere in the world. But yet it remains one of the most closed societies in the world. So it creates a lot of instability. No one really has insights into what's happening there. The royal family that has ruled there is one of the most cohesive families in making policy. And King Fahd was one of those billionaires that was on the Forbes list. He had $22 billion at that time. I haven't seen most recent estimates, but still a fairly wealthy family. But they've had a continued problem with unemployment. Unchecked, you know, population growth in these countries is tremendous. And so we have a significant problem amongst many of the Arab nations of high unemployment. Saudi Arabia, since 2001, when we had the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center, has been in question as to their involvement. And the question has always been, can we really trust them? I think as we can see today, 5 to 10 years, there could be some, I think, some fairly significant social eruption there. It could get very bad, I think, even before it's obvious to the outside world because of that closed society. And because of that top-down control, where really that family controls a lot, it could be very sudden, could be very explosive. But I think if we look at global stability, if there is any right now, but if you look at the long-term threat that really threatens to highlight it and isolate it in that Middle East, I think it's no question it's Saudi Arabia. Well, then let's look at Israel. Of course, Ariel Sharon was the leader. He was the last leader that really helped to create the Jewish state. After him, those were not involved. And so he was really defined in many ways by that Israeli-Arab conflict. He was very comfortable with it. But then remember, 3 years ago now, he suffered this debilitating stroke that took him out of the picture. And he was replaced by Ehud Olmert. And just last month, still March, yeah, last month in February, of course, the election went in favor of not Netanyahu. You know, Israel doesn't elect a person. They elect a party. And then who's ever leading that party, it's up to them to put together a government. So Benjamin Netanyahu's party really took over at that point. He actually has until, I think it's Monday, day after tomorrow, to put his government together, or else they may even have to have new elections if they can't do it. So it's a very different kind of democracy than what we're used to. And Netanyahu came in there with that. Now, interestingly enough, you know, Netanyahu is not like his predecessors. He has called the U.S.-backed peace talks a waste of time. At the same time, he's refused to commit to having a two-state solution, sharing the land of Israel with them. Other Israeli leaders have, but if he comes into power, it's likely that we may see some harsher conflict. So there's a generational shift. I think it raises kind of a key question. As we see the last decade, change the leadership, reformatting the Middle East. You've got lesser authoritarian governments, excuse me, fewer outsized dominating political rulers. Does it mean more stability, or does it mean more tension? Does it mean more confusion coming out of that area? Let's take the example of Hosni Mubarak of Egypt. You know, he's ruled since 1981. And, of course, a year ago, he allowed politicians to run against him. He won by a landslide. But he was harassed, his supporters were dispersed, some weren't allowed to run, and 20% of the parliament is now a Muslim Brotherhood. Now, he has a real, his conflict with Netanyahu's main person that moves along that area is Lieberman, his minister to Egypt, over a remark last year when Mubarak refused to visit Israel. You can see what he told him. He told him to go below. And if you don't want to visit Israel, fine. We whipped you once, we'll whip you again. Well, he didn't say that, but that was the implication. So you see, it's a very different situation today. If we look at the known terrorist organizations that are there today, you know, sometimes we think of Al-Qaeda being the only one, but there are a long list, and I've listed some here. There are other pockets, but these are the main ones. You can see that from Fatah, and the PLO to Al-Qaeda, Cairo, and what they seek. There's one common thing, one common theme with all of them. And what is that one common theme? The destruction of Israel. They all want the destruction of Israel. And the U.S. because of our support. And you know, if we go back to the war in Lebanon with the Hezbollah, that was the time that Israel was a big loser in that war. They lost kind of that aura of invincibility that was there for all the times that they were defending themselves. And it was the first time in their whole 60-year history that they failed to defeat an army. Now, you could question as to why that was, and perhaps they were handcuffed. But it did, they earned from that point on, it's been a continuous worldwide reproach on them for bombing against civilians. And we've seen the same thing happen in the Operation Cast Lead. And they really didn't accomplish a lot of their goals at that point. Well, we go back to Iran and Ahmadinejad. Jane's Defense Weekly claims that Syria and Iran signed an agreement to help each other. And that accord said, we'll help each other resist the pressure that we're getting regarding nuclear weapons and the misdeeds. Member Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has also said that I want to finish what Hitler started and wipe the Jewish people off the map. So if that's true, and it's never been verified, but it was claimed, I think, on good sources, I consider Jane's Defense Weekly a pretty good source, that Syria and Iran have this secret agreement. Without a presence there of some kind threatening against Iran, the Iranian army would be the strongest regional military force that's there. And I think, as you read the papers, and I do, you know, they're very close, if not already in possession of a nuclear weapon that would be big enough to be a viable threat. And of course, Ahmadinejad remains very eager to assert himself and have Iran play a much bigger role in the Middle East and on the world stages. So I think it is an important thing that if we think about what's happened with our economy, the European economy, all those, it really has cramped the ability to respond. Now, fortunately, some of that fall off is going into many of these Middle East countries, but they have certain wealth that we don't have and possess. But yet, certainly today, we see a much different picture of the ability to respond to, or the willingness to even respond to a crisis commitment in Israel. Well, let's take a look at some of the promises God has given to Israel, because I think it's important as we sort of bring this, wrap up this whole area. In Amos 9, 14 and 15, God gave a promise to Israel. He said, I will restore the captivity of my people, Israel. They will rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They will also plant vineyards and drink their wine and make gardens and eat their fruit. I will also plant them on their land, and they will not again be rooted out from the land which I have given them, says the Lord your God. Of course, I think we realize that that started with the small village and small settlement of Petah Tikva, and has blossomed into a great nation today. Isaiah 11, 11 and 12, God says that his covenant people Israel would return never again to be removed. In Isaiah 11, 11, 12, he says, then it will happen on that day that the Lord will again recover. Notice he says the second time. It's not talking about the first restoration of Israel out of Babylon. I think it's talking about this second time, the recovering of Israel to a land that would be theirs. With his hand, the remnant of his people who will remain from Assyria, Egypt, Pathros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. And will gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. I don't think I put the slide in here, but you know there's some significant things that happened over the last few years. In May of 2005, Israel crossed a distinct point of return. There are now more Jews in Israel than there are anywhere else in any other country. God has regathered them to a point where even the West no longer dominates. But I think it does mean that they wouldn't continue to migrate. But I think Israel has reached that crossroads where today, Israel, there are more Jews in Israel than in any other country. Notice what Jeremiah 31, 31 to 33 says. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not like the covenant which I made with them, with their fathers, in that day I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. But then he says, I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it. and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. So God does have a plan for them. His plan is to make them the center of his establishment of the kingdom when he brings that new covenant to everyone in that resurrection. Israel will be the format for that position. Now, before that time, we do know we have to still experience the completion of the church. We have to go through some of the difficulties of the time of trouble. But as I've talked about the changes in the Middle East, one of the things I do think we still see ahead for Israel, and one of the things we can read on our timeline of events, is I believe there will be another significant Israeli-Arab war before the final climax of the time of trouble, and perhaps even settled there. But Isaiah 11:14 reads, "But they shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west, and they shall spoil them of the east together, and they shall lay their hand upon Edom and Moab, and the children of Ammon shall obey them." Now, some would say this is a picture that goes into the kingdom, but I really think in the context of Isaiah 11, we have a description here of Israel's victory over its neighbors that are hostile. Those that would be surrounding them, eventually they would deal with, and dwelling at peace and safety before that final time comes. Well, let's look at the conclusions. I think the day of full restoration of Israel is near. We can see them regathered for many, many years. We can see them gathering on today. We can see the changing shift of everything. We can see the days when Israel will receive a new covenant. We can see the time when Israel's land is theirs forever. And that's something we should rejoice in. I think as difficult as we know times ahead, God is behind it, blessing them as a nation, and brethren, encouraging us to maintain our fortitude to go forward and remember that the Lord is at control in all he does. Amen.